Hello, welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona, and every week I read from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. I have a must list for us. I have a very long article about the movie The Apprentice, which was on last week's must list, but we already had a long article for last week, and there's no way I was going to be able to get in two of those. So this week I have the article about The Apprentice and more. So first up, the must list. La Machina, a Celia Cruz and Johnny Pacheco remaster, and Hannah Gadsby's new show top this week's must list. A Peacock series starring Scott Speedman and an Anna Raich historical fiction novel round out our picks for the weekend. This is by the Entertainment Weekly staff. I love fantastic prestige TV. But man, I also love any show that dares to give us a B-NATO. I'm a disaster movie superfan. Team Dante's Peak, if you're wondering. So when 9-1-1 premiered 6 years ago, I knew it was for me. With its pulse-raising action and campy craziness grounded by performances from the likes of Angela Bassett and Peter Cruz. Following a season 8 opener that gave us 22 million killer bees, the past 2 weeks served up a plane catastrophe that had me on the brink of tears for one reason or another throughout. I'm bummed the flame is dying out on the spinoff 9-1-1 Lone Star after its current fifth season on Fox, but thankful the mothership burns bright on ABC. That was Patrick Gomez, editor-in-chief. Here's our first must-list item, La Machina. Gael Garcia Bernal and Diego Luna reunite in this darkly funny, surreal Spanish-language drama about an aging boxer and his loquacious manager and best friend. An embarrassing loss leaves Eduardo La Machina Asuna, played by Bernal, ready to retire from the ring, but his manager, Andy, Luna hidden under prosthetics, pressures him into a rematch. Alas, they must also defeat a shadowy boxing cabal, along with Eduardo's CTE-fueled hallucinations. Suspenseful and strange in all the best ways, La Machina is a contender for one of the best shows of the year. Celia and Johnny. Named to the National Recording Registry in 2014, this collaborative album ascended Celia Cruz to international stardom with Dominican band leader and Fania Records founder Johnny Pacheco. This 50th anniversary reissue celebrates the globalization of salsa and highlights Cruz's unique matancera style. Teacup. In this Peacock drama, Maggie, played by Yvonne Strahovski, and James, played by Scott Speedman, are on the verge of divorce when a mysterious force traps them and several neighbors on their isolated Georgia ranch. Forget marriage counseling. Nothing brings a couple together like battling something sinister in the darkness. Hannah Gadsby, Woof. Looking inward in their new show through October 27th in NYC, the Australian comic examines the changes that come with fame since soaring to stardom with Nanette. They tackle everything from Taylor Swift to Olympic soccer to whales. Lots and lots of whales. The Stone Witch of Florence. Indulge in the witching season with author Anna Raich's haunting tale of a woman who can harness the power of gemstones to heal the sick. Summoned to Florence in the wake of the Black Plague, she is caught in the conspiracy. It's a twisty, historical, witchy escape. Those are the must-list items of the week, and it was by the Entertainment Weekly staff. So let's get to this long article from the movies section. Made in America, how polarizing biopic The Apprentice charts Donald Trump's origin story. Sebastian Stan and Jeremy Strong take Entertainment Weekly inside the making of a film so controversial no major Hollywood studio would touch it. This is by Mike Miller. Sebastian Stan didn't become Donald Trump until the helicopter took off. Moments earlier, before the rotor blades whirled, director Ali Abbasi was getting nervous. After 5 years of preparation and delays, the Iranian-Danish filmmaker was finally rolling on what would become this year's most controversial film, the Trump origin story, The Apprentice, in theaters October 11th. But when he looked at his star sitting across from Jeremy Strong in character as Trump's notorious mentor, Roy Cohn, he had a sinking feeling something wasn't right. I was looking at them like, wow, they look weird, man. Is this going to work? Abbasi tells Entertainment Weekly a year later from Copenhagen. Then the chopper starts lifting, and I'm like, well, I guess I'm going to find out. Once they were in the air, a transformation occurred that neither Abbasi nor the actors can fully explain. Suddenly, it started to work, the director says, and I thought, if it's working here, it's probably going to work on the ground, too. Until you cross that Rubicon, there's a certain measure of dread and uncertainty, says Strong, sitting next to Stan at their Entertainment Weekly cover shoot last month. So that, compounded with the fact that we were up in the air precariously in the helicopter, being buffeted around by the wind, was a fitting first day. Also, neither of us are really great flyers, Stan admits with a laugh, but as Donald and Roy, there were no nerves. We didn't even realize that we were in the helicopter. Strong adds, it's like putting on a magic cloak. Making the deal. Like their characters 50 years earlier, the actors first met at a loungy club in New York City. For Strong and Stan, it marked the beginning of a partnership that would culminate in a film so polarizing that no major Hollywood studio would touch it. For the future president and his closest advisor, it was the beginning of a toxic relationship that would change not only their lives, but the course of American history. If those two hadn't met, everything might be different, Strong says of Cohn and Trump's fateful 1973 encounter, which plays out in the film's opening scenes. I really think it's that portentous and that significant. Whether the closeted Cohn was physically attracted to the tall, blonde 27-year-old is unclear, though the movie hints that was part of his initial interest that night. Regardless, after helping Trump and his father settle a racial housing discrimination lawsuit with the Department of Justice, the lawyer took the wannabe mogul under his wing, molding him into a living symbol of American wealth and excess. Cohn's three rules for winning: always attack, deny everything, and never admit defeat remains core tenets of Trump's political playbook. Looking back on his first meeting with his co-star Stan, chatting again with Entertainment Weekly a few days later, now suspects that the Succession Emmy winner, famous for immersing himself in his characters, purposely selected a cocktail bar with a similar vibe to Le Club, the former members-only Upper East Side hotspot where Cohn first set his bulbous pale blue eyes on the ambitious young real estate scion. I remember I sat there and Jeremy said, "You want to have a cocktail?" And I said, "I'm not going to drink because Trump doesn't drink," the actor recalls. And he goes, "Well, you drink with me." Stan couldn't argue. As depicted in The Apprentice, Cohn was perhaps the only person capable of pressuring the teetotaling Trump into having a cocktail. Right from there, I felt like, okay, we're both going to go for this 100%, Stan says. I never saw him out of costume, and he never saw me out of costume. We never really met or spoke outside of the scenes or when we were on set. After they finished filming, Stan went to see his co-star's Tony-winning performance of Henrik Ibsen's An Enemy of the People on Broadway. When he stopped by his dressing room after the show, Strong says, "I felt like I was meeting him for the first time." The results of their shared commitment are undeniable. Under the unique direction of the visionary filmmaker behind Holy Spider and Border, and armed with a whip-smart, meticulously researched script by renowned journalist Gabriel Sherman, also known for the loudest voice in the room, the actors disappear completely into their roles. This sounds like one of these Hollywood cliches, but I really couldn't imagine a better cast, Sherman says. But when Stan was first approached for the role, the actor couldn't see himself as a young Trump. It's funny, I felt similarly about a few things I've worked on, he admits. My initial reaction is, wow, how the hell am I going to do this? This time, his friends and family also had concerns. I had people tell me not to do it, Stan says. I had people tell me I don't look like him. I had people tell me that it's not safe for me to do it. I had people say that I shouldn't try to alienate half the country. Other actors had already passed, quote-unquote, too scared to take on the challenge, Sherman says. But Stan found the anxiety weirdly motivating. He attributes this to his very interesting relationship with fear, which he's learned to use as a guide. Abbasi also wasn't sure the square-jawed Marvel superhero was the best choice. But when he looked closer at Stan's work, he saw an encouraging pattern. In recent projects, the actor has brought out the humanity in a mind-controlled assassin, that's in The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, a hard-partying rocker in Pam and Tommy, and a cannibalistic serial killer in Fresh. What's so interesting with Sebastian's career is that he has been doing all sorts of not very sympathetic characters, Abbasi says. But then when you actually see him, when Sebastian does his thing, they become, in a strange way, likable, even if they're douchebags. Uncovering the humanity in monsters is a skill set Abbasi shares with his star. His most recent film, Holy Spider, nominated for the Palme d'Or at the 2022 Cannes Film Festival, found fleeting pathos in a fanatical serial killer. His sophomore film, Border, winner of the same festival's Un Certain Regard Award in 2018, is a moving love story about literal trolls. If he could make trolls feel like real characters, Sherman says, I knew that he would be able to do something really fascinating with Trump. While his films can be fantastical, Abbasi, making his English language debut here, strives to uncover deeper truths in his work. I love reality. I don't watch that many movies and TV shows anymore, he says. I watch a lot of YouTube and TikTok to see what I think is a depiction of reality. That approach informed The Apprentice's unique visual style, which evokes news footage from the 70s and 80s. Roy Cohn's superpower, which he taught to Donald, is the way he handled the media, Abbasi explains, so it felt fitting to be inspired by those newsreels and the archival footage. Becoming the Donald. Once Stan was on board, he dove into a rigorous research process. I have always felt there was something to the man that needed to be heard, he says. If you do the research, there's a lot that you can understand. I thought about what may have been a driving force in his life, separate from the gimmicks and the lips. Despite Trump's wealthy upbringing, not everything in his early life was easy. He had a contentious relationship with his domineering father, Fred, played by Martin Donovan, who relished pitting his eldest sons against each other. When Trump was 13, his father found his collection of switchblades, bought after seeing West Side Story, and shipped him off to a military academy known for corporal punishment. When his older brother, Fred Jr., played by Charlie Carrick, spurned the family business to follow his dream of becoming a pilot, their father all but disowned him. Years later, after Fred Jr. died from alcoholism at 42, Trump made a rare admission of regret over the way he and his father treated him. Normalizing the story and understanding the driving factors that can lead someone on a certain path is what is of value here, Stan says. At the same time, Abbasi points out, there is a range between having empathy for someone and having sympathy with someone. Sherman kept that in mind while writing his script. Whatever my subject is, I always strive to find the humanity in them, he says, adding, but that doesn't mean absolving the character of their flaws. If there was one quality Stan related to the most, it was Trump's innate need to succeed. It's an urge Stan has reckoned with since he immigrated to the United States from Romania at age 12. I understood that drive to rise, to overcome at whatever cost, and to win. I understood that simply from my own very, very small, humble beginnings with the American dream, he says. We love a winner in this country. It's a fact that, to me, felt relatable in many ways. When it came to the physical aspect of becoming Trump, Abbasi says he had a narrow path to navigate. If he added 10% more prosthetics, it would look like a Saturday Night Live. But if he went 10% less, it would just be Sebastian in a wig. The tinkering continued until the cameras rolled. We were getting closer to shooting and hadn't agreed on the prosthetics. That's when Ali said, "Maybe you should start gaining weight in your face because you're older now, so your cheeks are more hollow, and it's not Marvel," Stan recalls with a laugh. So he called a nutritionist. He was like, "What I need you to do is get ramen and add a bunch of soy sauce and start having that." The sodium, he said, would puff up Stan's face. The Master. While not as iconic as Trump's signature swoopy hair, pouty lips, and orange glow, Cohn was also known for his singular appearance. He wore flashy suits over his thin frame and had eyes that seemed to bulge from the sides of his scarred face, the result of plastic surgeries gone wrong, and spent too much time in his tanning bed, one of his many quirks that Trump copied. But Strong opted to keep it simple on the surface. "It has to go beyond something simply mimetic," he explains. "You're trying to render, with a certain level of exactitude, this person, their behavior, in Roy's case, the way he spoke and carried himself physically. But that stuff is all, in a way, cosmetic. The real thing that you grapple with is trying to understand them as best you can and inhabit their struggle." With this, it was peering into the heart of darkness. As he did with Stan, Abbasi saw in Strong an ability to conjure an inner grotesqueness without veering into an impersonation. Jeremy is, in a way, an unusual actor. Even other actors think Jeremy is unusual, and they're all weird, Abbasi jokes. But the unusual thing about Jeremy is that he can be very intellectual and very intuitive at the same time. In his heyday, Cohn was the most feared attorney in New York, not as much for his legal acumen as for his willingness to do anything to win. He made a name for himself as a young prosecutor in the Julius and Ethel Rosenberg spy trial before becoming Senator Joseph McCarthy's right-hand man, as portrayed by Tony winner Will Brill in last fall's Showtime limited series, Fellow Travelers, helping him purge the government of alleged communists and homosexuals. This despite being openly gay amongst his closest friends. Cohn had famous clients on both sides of the aisle, including George Steinbrenner, Andy Warhol, Aristotle Onassis, and the heads of New York crime families. And yet, by the time he died of AIDS-related complications in 1986, many of his associates, including Trump, had abandoned him. "There were a lot of really strange things about this guy," Abbasi says. "He was a freak, but also he was extremely powerful. He was a closeted gay, an intellectual, a crooked lawyer who knew everyone and anyone, and had a room full of stuffed frogs." Strong researched Cohn extensively, and while he never got a clear explanation for this frog collection, he did find ways to empathize with a man some consider among the most despicable Americans of his time. Maybe that's a character flaw of mine, Strong reflects, but it is a requirement of the work that I do. Room to play. While The Apprentice is based in fact, improvisation was crucial to Abbasi's vision. Ali has a very interesting, very unique directing style, Sherman says. He likes to do really long takes where he won't yell cut. Basically, the actors will do the scene that's on the page, and then he'll see what happens. A lot of times it doesn't work, but then you get these really great moments. The author cites a scene briefly shown in the trailer as an example. As Trump and Cohen walk through an Atlantic City casino, they pass a crowded buffet that was not in the script. Reacting to his surroundings, as Trump might, Stan decided to grab a plate and serve himself a helping of fried cheese balls. "He deserves combat pay for that scene," Sherman jokes. "We did so many takes, he must have eaten 5,000 calories of cheese balls. It was disgusting. I ate one bite and almost retched." Opening the door to that kind of improvisation meant the actors had to be extremely well-read in terms of not just our characters, but also the time period and what was happening in New York, Stan explains. To prepare, he memorized everything from the names of local politicians to the players on the New York Mets over the film's decade-plus time span. Sebastian always knew that there would come a time when I would ask him to improvise, and he was dreading it, Abassi said, with a grin. Even Maria Beklova, who stars as Trump's first wife, Ivana, felt a learning curve. Despite improvising most of her breakout Oscar-nominated performance in Borat's subsequent movie film, she says working with Abassi was much different because with Borat, we did a lot of improv, but here we were mostly following what people were telling us and adapting in the moment. Ali is interesting because he changes the way you act. He just manages to throw things at you. Crossing the line. While the film has several moments of levity, it doesn't shy away from its subject's darkest moments. In a gut-wrenching scene that drew criticism after the film's premiere at the Cannes Film Festival, The Apprentice depicts the future president raping his wife. It's a horrifying episode that the filmmakers believe was necessary to confront head-on. I think it was incredibly important to put in the film from a characterological perspective because this movie is really trying to show the roots of where Donald Trump today came from, Sherman argues, adding, Trump has been credibly accused of sexual assault by multiple women. That includes his ex-wife, who, according to one unconfirmed account, accused her then-husband of rape in a 1990 divorce deposition. While Ivana later denied her initial testimony, she said she felt violated but did not mean to be alleging rape in a literal criminal sense, Sherman says. Speaking as a writer, not a journalist, what felt most emotionally true to me was the statement she made in real time under oath. I think it's got a lot of attention because usually people censor those things, Abassi says of the scene. My biggest interest is to depict the character in his full complexity, and I think part of that, which is a really important point in the story, is how egocentric Donald becomes. He crosses that line with someone he loved. I don't think that's a scene about sexual assault itself. I think it's a scene about the balance of power and empathy. You don't want to show people something like this because it's painful, Beklova says. Things like this should not exist. Unfortunately, they do exist, and when they do exist, you have to shine a light on them. In terms of shooting the scene, the actress says she had the support of a great team, including intimacy and stunt coordinators. It all felt safe, but it's still uncomfortable. The Apprentice has been courting controversy since before it landed a release date. Beyond its most shocking scenes, including visuals of Trump undergoing liposuction and scalp reduction surgery, both of which the former president has denied, some critics have taken issue with how the film attempts to empathize with two men whom many don't believe deserve empathy. "I have heard people say that, and I know what they mean," Strong admits. "There are certain historical figures that you think, why would you want to see them humanized?" There's also a valid argument to be made in terms of, well, I know what happened. I know what kind of guy he is. I see him all the time. Stan adds, "Still, I think there is value in normalizing people that we feel strongly about. And people feel very strongly about him in two different extremes. He's either God's son or he's Lucifer incarnate, and I think we need to bring him back down to earth." After recently making headlines for suggesting the 45th president isn't as dumb as late-night pundits suggest, Stan now takes the idea a step further. I think there's a Trump in all of us, to some extent, he says. I know that might not be a popular thing to say, or people might not want to admit it. And if they have that strong of a reaction to it, they should actually question that reaction. Abbasi finds the criticism itself concerning. I think it's dangerous to worry about humanizing people too much, he says. Also, for me, the movie is not a Trump movie. It's not a Trump biopic. Young Trump is part of it, but the way I see it, the movie is bigger than Trump. It's about the American power system. Making Hollywood Great Again. For all its merits and good intentions, The Apprentice is a movie with the unique potential to upset both sides of the political divide. Where some might buck at the idea of seeing Trump as anything less than a monster, others will be loath to see him as anything other than a natural-born winner, let alone the creation of a gay Jewish socialite. There's also another elephant in the room. While Sherman has been working on this project for more than 7 years, fate has seen fit, with help from a global pandemic and 2 Hollywood strikes, to deliver it to theaters 25 days before the U.S. election. With Trump, who has already threatened to sue the filmmakers, potentially returning to the White House, what studio would risk getting on his bad side? In the end, the answer was Briarcliff Entertainment. Founded by Tom Ortenberg, the former CEO of Open Road Films, the distributor swooped in at the last second to shepherd the film into theaters before the election. Throughout his career, the exec says he's targeted films that are provocative, informative, and entertaining. I think The Apprentice checks all of those boxes, he says, adding that he believes it has the opportunity to have a large societal impact. Whether he's thrilled to have acquired the film, Ortenberg says he's surprised that larger studios were too cowardly to invest earlier. I suppose I shouldn't be surprised anymore at anybody's cowardice, but it was disappointing to be sure, he says. I think our industry has generally become very conservative and toothless, Abbasi adds. I understand from a business perspective, not wanting to have trouble, but also we're not in the business of ice creams. We're not selling shoes. While the director admits the July assassination attempt on Trump freaked me out, he stands by his feeling that the film is fair and hopes it will prove that some risks are worth taking. I think we did stuff that a lot of people advised us not to do, he says, and I really hope that this model of taking chances is rewarded by the audience, not only for us, but also for the health of this whole ecosystem. While the cast and filmmakers see the release date, no matter how coincidental, as largely fortuitous for the project, they also recognize the gravity of this election. It feels very loaded, Strong says. Beyond the threat Trump poses to democracy, he adds, the damage he will do to the climate if he's elected will be incalculable, and I think irrevocable. That fills me with terror. Still, as much as they want audiences, including Trump, to see the film, the cast and filmmakers insist they're not trying to change votes. Instead, Stan says he hopes the movie leads people towards a reconnection with their own humanity. He adds, it's important to explore the darker elements that live within all of us, so that by bringing them into the light, we can understand how to have a better relationship with them rather than pretending they're not there. We have to have a better, healthier relationship with the beast in all of us. That was Made in America, how polarizing biopic The Apprentice charts Donald Trump's origin story, and it was by Mike Miller. I told you that was a long article, and that's why I couldn't do that one along with the other long article last week. So we're already past the midpoint. I'll mention here that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly, and I am reading from their website, EW.com. So next we have the continuation of an even longer article, but I've been reading in pieces. It's the fall TV preview, and these are the shows that are coming out in the following week. First up, it's Tracker, which is on CBS on October 13th. The Shaw siblings aren't messing around when Tracker returns. Although the mystery of what Dory, played by Melissa Roxburgh, is up to with her father's files will be explored a little later on, Russell Shaw, played by Jensen Ackles, will make an appearance early in season two. He comes in at the highest point, showrunner Elwood Reed teases, and it isn't a proper Shaw brother reunion without at least one family secret. There's a secret that is revealed about their father in the first episode that lands with both brothers, Reed says. There's a memory, you'll see, that Coulter doesn't have that his brother does have about Coulter and their father. Now that the brothers are on better terms, perhaps they can actually compare notes about their childhoods? NCIS Origins is on CBS October 14th. NCIS fans may have spent 19 seasons getting to know Mark Harmon's character Leroy Jethro Gibbs, but the version of the special agent they'll meet in his prequel series, NCIS Origins, is very much his own man. Narrated by Harmon, who also serves as an executive producer, Origins shines a spotlight on a young, grieving Gibbs's, played by Austin Stowell's, early days at NIS Camp Pendleton under team leader Mike Franks, played by Kyle Schmid, after a devastating experience changes his life forever. The Gibbs that we find on our show, it's not the guy that the fans are used to, Stowell tells Entertainment Weekly. This is someone who's going through a lot of pain. He's suffered a tremendous tragedy just 4 months before we pick up this show, and there's a lot of newness in his life. There's lots of firsts going on right now. NCIS itself. No extra description to it, just NCIS, October 14th, also CBS, of course. It's been 6 months since Jessica Knight, played by Katrina Law, accepted the React chief job in California, and her departure has since created what showrunner Steve Binder calls a chain reaction with the crew. Timothy McGee, played by Sean Murray, vies for a deputy director position, and Nick Torres, played by Vilmer Valderrama, returns to his undercover roots. The team kind of separates, so picture Parker, played by Gary Cole, walking into the bullpen and the kids aren't home, says Binder. It's not long before a case leads Parker out west, though, reuniting him with Jessica, who may or may not be mulling whether she made a mistake for leaving boyfriend, Jimmy, played by Brian Deedson, behind. Under the worst circumstances possible, will these two have the talk, quips Binder. All in all, expect heavy-hitting episodes filled with romance, fun and unusual pairings, and mystery. Like, who the hell is Lily, played by Sunny Pellant? I wouldn't be so sure that Parker knows who she is either, teases Binder. We don't always remember the scars of our youth. FBI International, October 15th on CBS. Jesse Lee Soffer played Detective Jay Halstead for 189 episodes of Chicago PD, as well as on a few crossover episodes of Chicago Fire and Chicago Med. And now he's making the leap from the Windy City to, well, all over the world. This season, Soffer is joining FBI International as the freewheeling special agent Wes Mitchell, a character and an opportunity that he's savoring. He sort of flies by the seat of his pants, Soffer says, while filming in Budapest. He has a really carefree attitude about it, and he's just going to do his thing, and he's a breath of fresh air. He's a lot of fun. But that insistence hides a darker side, as it so often does. When Mitchell's partner is shot in Los Angeles and the suspects flee to Budapest, Mitchell follows them on the fourth season premiere. Mitchell also shares a history with Cameron Vo, played by Vanessa Vidotto, which we'll see play out over the season. Shrinking is back October 16th on Apple TV+. Pull up a couch and get ready for more shrinking. After Jimmy, played by Jason Segel, resorted to unconventional methods, treating his patients with blunt honesty, he must now face the fallout of his candor, not to mention try to fix all the relationships he damaged while mired in grief over losing his wife. There's his daughter, Alice, played by Lucetta Maxwell, his mentor, Paul, played by Harrison Ford, his co-worker and friend, Gabby, played by Jessica Williams, his best friend, Brian, played by Michael Urie, and his next-door neighbor, Liz, played by Krista Miller. We wanted to be honest about the fact that Jimmy was doing an unorthodox approach to therapy and that there are consequences to that, says Segel. There are reasons that people aren't out there doing this. So he's going to have to reckon with the good and the bad of that approach. He's in a much better place in terms of the grief process. And then, very quickly, he's forced to confront a new challenge. Elsbeth on CBS, October 17th. Elsbeth Tessioni, played by Carrie Preston, is back on the case. The eccentric lawyer turned investigator may have a more permanent position at the NYPD, but now she must prove herself. It's not something many police precincts have in place, so it's always a question of will she be able to hold down this particular job, Preston says. In the season premiere, Captain Charles Wallace, played by Wendell Pierce, and Officer Kaya Blank, played by Kara Patterson, will need Elsbeth's help on a case involving a disgruntled opera lover, played by guest star Nathan Lane. He's one of our finest actors, raves Preston. He certainly understands the genres like this that have a mixture of drama and comedy. The Pradeeps of Pittsburgh. This is on Prime Video starting October 17th. From Blackish writer Vijal Patel comes the story of patriarch Mahesh, played by Naveen Andrews, his self-assured wife Sudha, played by Sindhu V, their rebel daughter Banu, played by Sahana Srivinasan, epic mama's boy Kamal, played by Arjun Sriram, and Vinod, played by Ashwin Sakhbivel, their youngest, who, depending on who you ask, can do no wrong. Through conflicting interrogation room flashbacks, we'll witness the humorous yet heartwarming tale of the Pradeep family's first few months of life in America after immigrating from India. Patel expects the audiences will be particularly enamored with a certain Lost alum showing off his comedy chops. Expect a surprising comedic coming-out party for Naveen Andrews, Patel says. All around, Pradeep's is offering a fresh take on the immigrant sitcom, cleverly twisting the stereotypes that too often become a crutch. We are showing characters that are of today that have points of view and experience of today. Georgie and Mandy's First Marriage, October 17th on CBS. Spin-off series Georgie and Mandy's First Marriage picks up a few months after the events of the Young Sheldon finale, which saw the death of Georgie's dad. Georgie, played by Montana Jordan, and Mandy, played by Emily Osment, are still grappling with the loss and living with her parents and their baby, all while trying to navigate inner family politics and figure out their future. And while fans of its predecessor can expect lots of familiar faces, such as Will Sasso, Rachel Bay Jones, Zoe Perry, Annie Potts, and Regan Rufford, executive producer Steve Holland says he hopes audiences are just as excited as he was to dig into a different part of the Big Bang Theory television universe. This is the first time in 18 years that we're not writing for Sheldon, and Sheldon's a great character, and I'm so proud to have been a part of writing that character, but this is a different show, Holland says. I don't have to keep Googling science facts anymore or trying to pretend that I know what I'm talking about. This is a much more, I think, relatable family show. These are different characters. It's the same world, but the slice of this world they inhabit has a different flavor to it. Ghosts is October 17th on CBS. Three seasons in, Ghosts has a big paranormal sandbox, and in season four, they've invited the hilarious Mary Holland to play. In last season's finale, a vengeful spirit kidnapped Brandon Scott Jones's Isaac moments after he left his fiancée jilted at the altar. Holland is that vengeful spirit, the most puritanical Puritan, Patience, who was actually kicked out of her village for being a bit too much. So even by their standards, she's a lot to deal with, says co-showrunner Joe Wiseman. Patience has it out for Isaac since he abandoned her to the dirt by letting go of her hand so that he could sneeze. She's been wandering for 130 years or something like that, so she's a little upset, Wiseman reveals. But she's going to spend a few episodes at Woodstone and is going to mix things up there. Happy's Place is October 18th on NBC. Reba's back! 17 years after her first network sitcom went off the air, Reba McEntire returns to the format for Happy's Place. No longer a single mom who works too hard, who loves her kids and never stops, this time around the country queen plays Bobby, a woman who not only inherits a bar when her father dies, but also the half-sister that she never knew she had, Isabella, played by Melissa Escobedo. Reba alum Melissa Peterman is along for the fun, along with McEntire's real-life boyfriend Rex Lynn. "We have so much fun together," McEntire says of Peterman, while she shared some of the advice she gave Lynn for his first time on a sitcom. "I said, don't memorize everything off the first draft because they'll change it," McEntire recalled. "Get familiar with the blocking and everything, but don't nail everything down on the dialogue until the third or fourth day." Fire Country is October 18th on CBS. Fire Country will pick up where it left off with Gabriela Perez, played by Stephanie Arcila, standing at the altar preparing to wed Diego, played by Rafael de la Fuente. But the sparks that kick off the season 3 premiere won't be romantic. There will be a helicopter crash at some point in the ceremony, so the church full of firefighters and friends will be dealing with that, says Arcila. She'll also have to cope with the recent arrest of her father, Manny Perez, played by Kevin Alejandro. And Arcila says the viewers will see more of their relationship in future episodes. Gabriela and her ex, Bodie Donovan, played by Max Thiroux, meanwhile, will have a new dynamic this season. Teases Arcila, they will always love each other, but with him being out now and them possibly working together, they start developing a friendship in a normal environment. And our last show on this list for this episode, Blue Bloods, October 18th on CBS. The Reagan family is taking their final bow, which means audiences should prepare for the emotional gut punch of their last few Sunday night dinners. Yes, even after 14 seasons with the multi-generational clan of cops, Blue Bloods still has a few surprises left up its sleeve. There's some nice revelations in that last episode of season 14 that wrap up at that family dinner, Bridget Moynihan, who stars as Aaron Reagan Boyle, says of the family's last supper. "For us to go out on such a special family dinner on our last episode, I think will resonate with the fans." And as we bid a final farewell to Aaron, Danny, played by Donnie Wahlberg, Jamie, played by Will Estes, Henry, played by Len Carew, and Patriarch Frank, played by Tom Selleck, the season will be doling out endings that may delight and occasionally hurt its dedicated viewers. "Fans will really get a kick out of some of them," Moynihan says, "and then there might be a surprise that isn't so hopeful." So that's all from the list so far. I'm going to come back to it next week with What We Do in the Shadows, which will come out October 21st on FX. That long article last week was about Saturday Night Live and the movie Saturday Night, which is the lead up to the first ever episode. And here's an article on how to watch the first ever Saturday Night Live episode from 1975. This is by Wesley Stenzel. Saturday Night Live premiered 49 years ago on October 11th, 1975. With biopic Saturday Night now playing in theaters, it is the perfect time to revisit the show's first ever episode. Set in the 90 minutes leading up to SNL's first broadcast, Saturday Night peeks behind the curtain at the chaos of putting a countercultural live comedy show on the air for the first time. The film ends just as the show finally begins, which renewed our curiosity to revisit the actual first episode of the variety series. Fortunately for comedy fans, all 50 seasons of Saturday Night Live are currently streaming on Peacock. That means you can watch the very first episode of SNL, which features host George Carlin and musical guests Billy Preston and Janice Ian, by scrolling back to the very beginning of the show's catalog on the streamer. The first episode of the show introduced the world to cast members who have now become comedy legends. Chevy Chase anchors the first ever Weekend Update segment with special correspondence from Lorraine Newman. John Belushi gets a morbid English lesson from head writer Michael O'Donoghue. Dan Aykroyd tests the limits of Gilda Radner's home security. And Garrett Morris assists Jane Curtin in court as she writes down her disturbing testimony instead of speaking it aloud. The show hadn't solidified its now predictable structure at the time of the premiere, so the episode features a number of deviations from the contemporary SNL format that might surprise modern viewers. For example, Carlin has four different stand-up segments rather than the now standard singular monologue, and doesn't appear in any sketches. And there are a total of four musical performances, two each from Ian and Preston. The episode also features a number of segments supplied by comedians and entertainers who weren't part of SNL's cast. Legendary comic Andy Kaufman does a brief lip-sync routine to the Mighty Mouse theme. Albert Brooks provides a short film about bizarre news stories. Valerie Brumfield does her own short stand-up routine, and Jim Henson sends the Muppets into the land of Gorch for the first time. Saturday Night stars Gabriel LaBelle as SNL creator Lorne Michaels, Rachel Sennett as writer Rosie Schuster, Lamorne Morris as Garrett Morris, Corey Michael Smith as Chevy Chase, Dylan O'Brien as Dan Aykroyd, Ella Hunt as Gilda Radner, Kim Matula as Jane Curtin, Matt Wood as John Belushi, Emily Farron as Lorraine Newman, Tommy Dewey as Michael O'Donoghue, Cooper Hoffman as NBC exec Dick Ebersol, Willem Dafoe as NBC head of talent David Tabbitt, J.K. Simmons as Milton Berle, and many, many, many more. That was how to watch the first ever Saturday Night Live episode from 1975, and it was by Wesley Stenzel. This was the top article on the website when I opened it. Jim Parsons not interested in doing a The Big Bang Theory reboot for now. This is by Sydney Buxbaum. Bazinga! Jim Parsons is happy to leave The Big Bang Theory in the past. For now, anyway. When the actor behind Sheldon Cooper appeared as a guest on Who's Talking to Chris Wallace on Friday, he told host and CNN anchor Chris Wallace that he has no plans to return to The Big Bang Theory for a reboot or reunion. As we sit here now, no, Parsons said. But also, I never say never to anything because life just changes so much. One of the things is that it was so special at what it was and what it is. And they call it lightning in a bottle for a reason. And you can be certain it wouldn't be that. And so why would we be doing it? He went on to add, I don't know, that's how I feel on that right now, but like I say, God willing, life is very long. Looking back on his 12-season run on the popular CBS sitcom created by Chuck Lorre and Bill Prady about a group of nerdy scientists and the beautiful woman they befriend who lives across the hall from them, Parsons calls it the most insane, fortunate blessing that I could have ever asked for. That's why he's not mad that some people will always see him as Sheldon Cooper, no matter what other roles he's gone on to play, including his current run in the Broadway revival of Our Town. I feel pretty strongly that it's almost, if not totally, 100% blessing at this point, he said. I know that I wouldn't have said that 10 years ago. The Big Bang Theory aired from 2007 to 2019 and won Parsons 4 Emmys and 1 Golden Globe. He was also the highest paid actor on TV for several years, earning $27.5 million before taxes in 1 year. His character spun off into prequel series, Young Sheldon, which ran from 2017 to 2024 and featured Parsons as narrator and executive producer, as well as guest star in the series finale. Getting Big Bang stars Parsons, as well as Mayim Bialik, to reprise their roles in the Young Sheldon series finale was an easy ask. Honestly, we asked and they said yes, showrunner Steve Holland previously told Entertainment Weekly. We always, in the back of our mind, thought about having Jim appear on screen, and as we were talking about the finale, Chuck had pitched having Jim and Mayim back, and that just seemed really exciting. Jim's always been a part of the show, but mostly he lives in New York, so he does his voiceovers, and we mostly see him on Zoom. It's been a while since we've been in the same room with him. It was a nice little reunion to get to be with them both again. New episodes of Who's Talking to Chris Wallace debut Friday mornings on Max. That was Jim Parsons not interested in doing the Big Bang show. That was Jim Parsons not interested in doing the Big Bang Theory reboot for now. And that was by Sydney Buxbaum. From our TV section, Outer Banks should ditch the treasure hunting and let teens be teens. Season 4 has gone too far. This is by Samantha Highfill. At this point, or maybe always, Outer Banks is made up of two separate shows. There's the beach life teen drama about the kooks versus the pogues and how nobody can share a wave or attend the same bonfire without fighting because of classism and, well, hormones. Then there's the treasure hunting drama, where the pogues explore ancient caves and narrowly escape death at every turn. And up until season 4, I was fine with the split. I thought, this show can be both. I no longer think that. After 3 seasons of crazy treasure hunting adventures, the season 4 premiere felt like a breath of fresh air. The kids used their money to build Poglandia 2.0, a home where they could hang out together all the time, and a bait and tackle shop that could sustain them. It was their dream, and within that dream, there's plenty of drama to mine. How do teens successfully manage a business? How do 3 romantic couples live in a house together? How do they stop JJ, played by Rudy Pankow, from breaking everything and gambling away all their money? I loved it. And then, in season 2, not only did we head back to treasure hunting land, but in the name of always upping their game and or trying to do something new, the show appears to be digging more into the supernatural. This particular treasure, the Blue Crown, has everything to do with a family curse and, wait for it, a ghost. I know what you're wondering, and yes, we do see the ghost, and yes, it looks stupid. I'm not entirely convinced it's real, but either way, I don't need it. The juxtaposition between that first episode and the ones that follow was so jarring, and it made me realize something. I don't need the treasure hunting anymore, and I certainly don't need it to involve the supernatural. I'm far more invested in the everyday lives of these lovable beach bums. It's giving TV Blue Crush, which is an incredible compliment, by the way. And it's not like that story is lacking any key elements. The kooks are great villains because they suck. I mean, they run over baby turtles, which, for the record, was also too far. There are plenty of opportunities for conflict, not only with the Pogues' money struggles, but also with their romantic entanglements. Not to mention the fact that Pope, played by Jonathan Davis, seems to be the only one still caring about education. I understand that I'm asking the show to metaphorically cut off one of its limbs, but we're now 4 seasons deep, which means it's time for some change, especially when it becomes increasingly difficult to believe that the key to yet another unbelievable treasure is somehow Charleston, South Carolina. Fans love these characters. I would watch an entire episode of them trying to figure out how to cook Thanksgiving dinner on a budget, or shopping for sunscreen, or just laughing and jumping off a boat. The world of the Pogues is so rich, it doesn't need treasure. To make it all more interesting, one of the storylines this season is that John B., played by Chase Stokes, is scared he's becoming his father, someone who's obsessed with treasure, willing to do anything for it. So, let him leave it all behind. Let the teens just be crazy hot teens, and please, never show me that ghost, ever again. Outer Banks Season 4 Part 1 is streaming now on Netflix. Part 2 drops November 7th. That was Outer Banks Should Ditch the Treasure Hunting and Let Teens Be Teens. It was by Samantha Highfill. And that brings us to the end of our episode for this week. This is Entertainment Weekly, and I've been reading from their website, which is EW.com. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury. Thank you all for listening this week. Please come back next week to hear what I've found from the website. And until then, goodbye.